I would like to introduce our next speakers. We have the next session is titled Free and Open Technologies, a Policy Update from the European Union. And we have joining us two folks, Carsten Gerloff, who is the president of the Free Software Foundation Europe, and Graham Taylor, who's the chief executive of Open Forum Europe. And so as we get those slides set up, I'd like to welcome both of you. I thank you for joining us so early in the morning.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. This is Carsten from the Free Software Foundation Europe.
And this is Graham Taylor from Open Forum Europe. So the technology is working.
Fantastic. All right. Carsten, why don't you lead us off?
All right. Well, actually, we agreed that Graham would just briefly introduce the agenda for our call before each of us presents our organization, and then we head into the substance of the matter. Graham, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, sure. So if we could move to the next slide, which should be on the agenda. Yep, there we go. Great. So what we thought we would do this afternoon, as you gather, both Carsten and myself are from Europe. I'm a Brit, and Carsten can introduce himself properly in a moment. But what we wanted to do is just talk a little bit, first of all, about the two organizations and what we do. We are both very independent, as you'll hear in a moment, but we do work together quite closely at times. And what we thought for this session we'd try to do is to explain a little bit about what is happening in Europe, particularly in the public sector and government markets, both on open standards and free software, open source software. Look a little bit about who we think are the key influences in Europe, what's been happening in the past, and potentially, I think, much more importantly, what's happening at the moment and what we would like to see happening in the future. And there's good news, and I think there's also some more bad news, and there's some threats that we want to talk about. And then finishing off very much with the actions that we think would be we think are necessary, and maybe people have got some ideas and where they can come in on. So if we can move straight on from there, and I'll pass back over to Carsten on to the next slide.
Thanks, Graham. Just a few words on the Free Software Foundation Europe. We speak about free software as it's about, free as in freedom. We're a charitable non-profit organization that was founded in 2001 as an independent sister organization of the Free Software Foundation in the United States. Our goal is to ensure an equitable participation for everybody in the information society. Our principles that we're based on are independence, stability, and transparency. And perhaps most relevant for today's webinar, seminar, is that component of our work that we do in policy at the European Union, in European member states, at the United Nations, and at the World Intellectual Property Organization, where we simply try with our work to create a global framework that is conducive and helpful for free software and open standards. We create public awareness for free software among the general public in policy, in business, and in law. We represent the interests of free software wherever we can. We facilitate the world's largest network of legal experts on free software and work hard to bring fresh faces, young blood, into free software, into the community. And we do work with OFE, and I'll leave it to Graham to introduce OFE.
Okay, thanks, Carsten. Open Forum Europe. Well, we've been going now 7 years. We started very much as an organization looking to accelerate use of open source software in business, because at that time it was really only getting moving forward, certainly in Europe, in the corporate world, but there was an awful lot of people who were very wary about it and thought, well, if it's free, it can't possibly be good for you. And we tried to engender by using business language to get people interested in that. But over time, we've moved forward in a number of ways. We now have very much as our mission statement, open competitive choice in the ICT market. So as you see, that has moved us beyond just open source into open standards and other areas. We are, however, still very much not-for-profit. We are independent, fiercely independent, I would say, very much business-oriented still in what we're doing, and we do draw our members from both the suppliers and the community. So Red Hat is very much a member and very much an active member of Open Forum Europe. but particularly in Europe, we're talking about 27 different countries across Europe, and one of the lessons I learned from business and my background is as a business director for supplying before, is that you need to build very good partnerships, both at national level and with organizations that have got different strengths to yourselves. So we have a large number now of partners in countries, but also we work very closely with organizations such, of course, as Carsten and Free Software Foundation Europe, who we work, I think, with very close, although we do use different languages and times. Two things have happened then during those 7 years. One is clearly the market has moved fantastically fast. But secondly, we observed very quickly that we needed to move our base to be very much around open standards rather than just open source. But also, if we wanted to influence the influence, as we called it, then we need to make Brussels at our base. So that's actually now where our main office is based. So, back over to Carsten, and on to the next slide, please.
Right. I want to give a little basis to this whole policy talk. We'll be speaking a lot about open standards and about free software as well. But what I just want to do now is to explain why open standards are so important for free software and why an organization like Free Software Foundation Europe, which obviously has limited resources, dedicates so much energy to pushing open standards in Europe and elsewhere. Standards in general are a shared base for innovation. They create a platform that inventors can or innovators can build on, follow on innovators especially. We see the power of open standards when we think that the internet is built on them. Networking protocols like TCP/IP or networking services like HTTP, SSL, or SMTP, and so forth. There are a fair number of definitions of open standards out there, and not all of them agree. From our view, it's key that an open standard for a standard to be open, it's key that it can be implemented by anyone in any business model without asking for permission. That it doesn't depend on things which aren't open standards in themselves. That it's managed in an open process independently from any single vendor. The OOXML controversy comes to mind here. That it is ideally available in multiple competing implementations, at least one of them in free software, so that, there's competition in the implementation of the standard and choice. The great thing about open standards is that all innovators have the same opportunities. They're not limited to who can get a patent license, who can afford one of those patent licenses that they might need to implement a given standard. And that all these characteristics of open standards make it clear that free software needs open standards in order to thrive. Open standards mean interoperability, that programs can work together. And they also mean that components can be exchanged independently of each other in IT systems, in complex software systems. So it really comes down, when we talk about open standards, it really comes down to competition, to choice, and to freedom. So after that short outline, I'll be handing over to Graham to introduce the key bodies of the European Union.
Okay, Carsten, before I do that, perhaps I could add one other point to what Carsten has just made, and that is when we first started working with open source in the business and the public sector communities, we were frankly quite shocked by the degree by which existing organizations had locked themselves into past proprietary technologies. So for just taking one example, we did some work in the UK, and we identified that something like 90% of the public sector had lost their choice about freely choosing the next step, and that was all about choosing old proprietary technologies. And it was really, for us at least, that was the first driver that said we've got to move to full interoperability, because we found that without that, organizations were not able to take up as much open source as that we would hope that they could and would want to see. So that, I guess, is just an additional driver than what Carsten mentioned. But moving on then to the key bodies in the European Union, and I'm obviously very conscious here that a lot of the people on this webinar will not be in Europe and may not understand all the different nuances. We talk about Europe as a single entity, and we talk about Europe has decided. And it is quite actually important when we go through this just to understand. It's unfortunately not as simple as that. So at the top, really, what you have is an organization called the European Council, which is made up of the ministers from all of the member state governments. And there are something like 27 different member state governments that form the European Union. And it's at that point that they formally approve strategy and legislation. Then it goes something similar to what most countries would understand. So there is a parliament. This is a parliament across Europe. It's a voting chamber. And they can both demand on their officials what needs to be done, and they can also approve initiatives and make legislation. And it's then the European Commission, which is the organization that most people understand as being, if you like, central in Europe. This is the body of officials who undertake the bulk of the work. So it's made up of a series of directorates, each under an individual commissioner. And it's there where they do all the research, the development activity, do the thinking, produce the papers. But it still has to go to Parliament for voting. And then finally, of course, you have the individual member state governments. And as I said, 27 of them. And they have their own rules. They have their own officials. They have their own parliaments. In many cases, they can still just do whatever they want. So we talk about a single Europe, but in many cases, it's anything but that. And we very much still have to see this independent. So for organizations like FSFE and OFE, that means we really have to be out there meeting a lot of different people if you really do want to influence a key strategy. If we can move on to the next slide, I think I'm going to do this as one as well, Carsten. So that's
yes, right.
We said the European Commission really is the lead organization. It's made up of a whole raft of different directorates who drive different aspects of European policy. Now, in the ICT market, there are some that are very specifically in our marketplace, particularly IMFSO, the one at the top, which is essentially is the lead unit, which is driving ICT strategy. But you also find a number of other directorates which have impact as well. The one which most people hear about, particularly in the press, of course, is the work of competition, which is all about antitrust and about competition rulings. And many of you remember over the last couple of years two very major cases brought against Microsoft and very large penalties. But they also have very significant impact on the way that organizations work. And of course, it's not just IT, but it's very visible and it's a very, very powerful organization and set of people. So in our market, IMSO is the lead one. As I said, it works right the way from starting from research into new technologies, into areas of security, into areas of communication. And that is very important. And that is headed up by a lady called Neelie Kroes, who is from the Netherlands. She has just moved into this particular position, having been previously the Commissioner for Competition. And it was her who led the case against Microsoft. So a very powerful, very strong lady. And she's now moved into a new responsibility in IMSO. And she's taken on a program which actually spans all of the different directorates, and it's called Digital Agenda. And she's been made a vice president as well. But under her, she not only has her own unit, but she also has two other areas of particular interest to us in our market. The first one is an area which actually directly reports into DG Enterprise. And it's this group that has responsibility for the entire reform of the European standardization policy. And that covers every aspect, not just ICT, but all other parts of where standards are required in the market. But ICT now, we're pleased to say, has been separated out of that, and there is plan for a new reform of ICT standardization, and that is going to be a part of a digital agenda. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then there's another part of the European Commission who is mainly responsible for internal IT, delivery of IT. But some years ago, they took responsibility for setting the policy for interoperability on a wider basis in across e-government. You may have heard of the European Interoperability Framework. You may have heard of the work of IDABC. This is an extremely important piece of work, but unfortunately doesn't sit directly directly under her responsibility, and she has to matrix manage it. So it's we have, as you can see, once again, we have split responsibilities in these different areas. So I think that's enough on the structures, and then we can see actually what's important and what's coming out of these different units. So over to you, Carsten.
Thanks, Graham. On the next slide, I think you've given a very good overview of the structure of the European Union, which is indeed bafflingly complex even to most Europeans. I just want to try to fill those different levels that you mentioned with life a bit by giving examples of milestones we've achieved at the European Commission level, at the level of individual member state governments, and at the level of regions within those member states and perhaps organizations. So a major milestone at the Commission level was the European Interoperability Framework version 1. We will talk about a version 2 later, which is not quite as happy an event as version 1. But the European Interoperability Framework in its first version was published in 2004. Behind this enormous name is a recommendation by the European Commission to member states that aims at making sure that member states' public bodies and their IT systems can properly talk to each other across country borders. When you get a driving license in Greece and then move to France, will your driving license records still be recognized by the computer systems? That's the sort of thing they were looking at. So the European Commission published this framework as guidance, as a non-binding guidance in 2004. It contains a relatively strong definition of open standards along the lines of what I said earlier. That includes a requirement for any patents in those standards to be made available royalty-free. And this guidance, even though it was non-binding, ended up giving a lot of leadership to member states in creating their own national interoperability frameworks. So that led to a number of individual government policies. Now we're getting to the member state level, where, for example, in the Netherlands, I believe in 2003, there was a decision that the public sector should make use of open standards. So, for example, since January 2009, Dutch public bodies actually have to be able to deal with ODF. Finland recommends the use of open standards for public administrations. Belgium and the Netherlands, Belgium as a country is another promoter of open standards and has agreed with the Netherlands to cooperate on open standards policy and promote open standards and free software internationally. And now we're going to the regional level and the single organization level. Oh, no, sorry, I left out Denmark, which was the latest success, the latest milestone, where they recently decided that the Danish state public bodies would have to use ODF from April 2011. At the regional level, you have places like Extremadura in Spain, which used to be and still is very rural, somewhat, if any people from there are here, no offense meant, but somewhat backward province, who missed out on the Industrial Revolution. And together with Andalusia, another province in Spain, they said, we missed out on the Industrial Revolution. We're not going to miss out on the Information Revolution. And they've been relying heavily on free software and open standards to get ahead in putting computers in schools, in making sure that students catch up with the latest technologies and that their businesses, too, catch up with the latest technologies. The French gendarmerie, with, I believe, 70,000 to 100,000 desktop computers, is using free software on those computers. The city of Munich has migrated, that's a very prominent example, is in the course of migrating their 14,000 desktops to free software and relying on open standards. There are a good number of other examples where it's not quite as clear-cut. You have recommendations from governments, like in the UK, that aren't being properly followed up on. You have city governments like Berlin or Vienna that keep wavering back and forth. But on the whole, we've achieved a good number of migrations in the public sector and a good number of policies in the public sector where open standards are being relied upon as key to the IT strategies. So, Graham, do you want to move on to the next slide and talk a bit about the opportunities?
Yeah, thanks, Carsten. So this is bad news, good news time. Starting off with the good news, which is very much the opportunities. And we've put right up at the top of that the EIF, European Interoperability Version 2, which is the new version. Now, this document, the new version, went out on the consultation in 2008, so 2 years ago. The difference between version 1 and version 2 is that, as Carsten said, the version 1 was actually quite limited in its scope in terms of what it should be covering. It was talking about pan-European government applications, but in fact it's picked up there. Now, the new version will be formally recognized as in a European communication, which means the biggest impact on that is that we should be then seeing compatible national interoperability frameworks, that's the NIFs that's mentioned on this slide, which comes in across the whole of Europe. And certainly an aspect of that is that we should be seeing common use of open standards. Now, we'll talk a little bit more in the next slide about the bad news, because as you gather from my tone, is although we actually had a very high expectation of version 2 of the EIF, and indeed the consultation document was extremely positive, both in the use of open standards and effectively the mandating of an open standard and the maintenance of this very clear definition of an open standard. And in fact, it was extremely positive in the use of open source software. But we've now seen leaked versions of the new documents. It's been delayed, and we question exactly why that. So maybe this is no longer an opportunity, and what we're doing is trying to save what we see now as a bigger problem. The next area, which is very important when we're looking at standards and the use of open standards, as I said, is this reform of the ICT standardization policy. Those of you who followed the OOXML debate will understand that the role of ISO was very important here. Now, in Europe, the reason for that is that it's only the formal standards bodies that are allowed to define standards which are then legally recognized in Europe, which means that that governments in Europe can actually declare them formally in their strategy. And pretty obviously, in the ICT space, that is a real problem. So we, Free Software Foundation Europe and others, have been battling long and hard to get that the standards coming out of approved foreign consortia should have an equal legal recognition factor. You know, and everybody realized clearly, for example, on the internet W3C standards, there's no way that they're inferior to something coming out from, I don't know, ECMA or somewhere, or ISO in its general understanding. So that was one very important aspect, which I think we are now making some good progress on. But the second is that I think there has always been in the definitions is that essentially RAND prevailed. And clearly in the area of ICT, interoperability, software interoperability, we've been working very hard to get an understanding that in that area they should be royalty-free, and that's still an ongoing debate. But in other areas of ICT, certainly to avoid patent ambushes, etc., there should be the recognition of ex-ante rules. And both of those have come from nowhere. We've now got at least included in the text of those discussions. Some way to go, but that's still an important factor. And the third area that we see as an opportunity is we're getting recognized is that the most important way to get strategy, turning from strategy into practice, is by the use of public procurement. The new vice president for the Digital Agenda has picked this issue up in what she's been saying. She's used the term practice what we promote. And we think that is a really important aspect that we're certainly very much pushing as we go forward. So public sector procurement practice, what happens at member state level, is now then we think a very big opportunity to get people to understand that there is more opportunity in different areas for whatever reason, and that particularly would be advantageous to SME suppliers and also to the use of free software, open source software. So if we could move on to the next slide. Carsten, sorry, anything you want to come in on that?
Let me just check if we could get back to procurement later on. No, I'll do that on the next slide. That's fine.
Okay. So the threats, and I'll keep going and then Carsten, perhaps you interrupt me at the end. On EIF version 2, as I said, it started off very well. The consultation document was very favourable. We found it very positive indeed. And they set themselves something like 9 months to a year to get it formally published and go through Parliament after that consultation. All of the comments were made visible. They were published. Yet when we saw a leaked document, which only appeared October last year, it had been completely rewritten. It would, in our mind, deleted of all value. Support for open standards have been watered right down. The practice, what we promote, seemed almost to be turned on its head, and it was very much taking it back to the lowest common denominator, and use of open source seems to have almost disappeared out of the language.
I think, so, Graham, if I may briefly jump in here, that really was a key moment where we saw how strong, really, the lobby of the proprietary side is in Brussels. The contrary to the reasonably good draft that that we had seen in the public consultation of this version 2 of the European Interoperability Framework, the leaked document that we saw included things like an openness continuum, where proprietary software and standards are on one end and free software and open standards are on the other. That is somewhat like including North Korea in a democracy continuum.
Don't get political now, Carsten. Come on.
Sorry?
I said, don't get political now. Come on.
No, well, we are doing political work after all. Also, interoperability had suddenly been redefined as, well, if we all use the same proprietary program, then we have interoperability, which is not quite what we meant by it. But yes, Graham, you were going on to say about...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it was, the first leaked version, frankly, was just so bad that we were able, all of us, to press the red button in such a way that, in fact, that first draft got withdrawn based on a whole number of countries strongly objecting. And it went back into rewrite, and we thought, in fact, it was going to be significantly improved. It has slightly, and in that the example that Carsten gave has been modified, so it's less sort of awful, but it's still bad. And the latest we know on the EIF is that 8 member states have still written and co-signed a letter of objection to this current draft. And to my mind, that has never happened before. So this is a document that was meant to be developed in conjunction with the member states with their agreement. But quite clearly, Carsten put it gently, has been lobbied against very heavily. And we're continuing and will continue to fight the release of this document in its current format. And I think just picking up on this lobbying factor on the reform of ICT standardization, that is again where lobbying has had a very significant impact on it. This case by the formal standards bodies in the different countries, German DIN, UK British Standards, etc. And I think many of the questions that we still are pushing are being heavily lobbied against. So on the definition of the term standards, we know there's been an enormous battle internally in the European Commission, so much so that when the digital agenda was published, last week, it didn't use the term open standard, just used the word standard. Now, in fact, we're quite happy and very positive about the initiatives coming out, but it's an indication of this problem because the word standard, the term standard, is actually legally defined in Europe, and the people who owned it have blocked anyone modifying it in any way. So we clearly have an awful lot of bureaucracy, an awful lot of history that we're having to battle against as we move forward.
Indeed, and I think this is an example of how complex policy work in the European Union actually is, because you don't only have to, as an organization like OFE or FSFE, we don't only have to work against the interests of the other side, not to call them the dark side, but anyway, we're also having to deal with all sorts of internal commission, internal relationships, pre-existing conditions, shall we call them, where one person doesn't like each other, where one director general is jealous of another taking away its mandate, and so forth. And all these are things that we need to take into consideration.
Yep, indeed. So I think that's moving to maybe towards the end. But if I pass back to Carsten to finish off really with the actions that we are now working across and what we think is very important, and then hopefully we've got time to take some questions. So over to you, Carsten.
Yeah, I'll be very brief. Basically, the term or open standards will remain a key component of FSFE's work at the European level, and that's where we'll cooperate with OFE. So the term itself is hotly contested, and there are even some doubts whether it's useful to continue using that term or whether we might have to come up with a better one, because the other side is trying to get the so-called reasonable non-discriminatory patent licenses included in the definition of an open standard. That is not what we need. We need patent licenses that are indeed reasonable and non-discriminatory for free software, and that means royalty-free. Anything else is simply not something we can consider an open standard. We need to get this definition into the policies not only of the European Union, but also of the member states. We need to keep pushing standardization reform, as Graham outlined. The goal of this is to open up the market to competition, to especially get the public sector to buy more free software, to use more open standards. That will open up the market for competition, and free software can show its natural advantages there. Also, that will give users and citizens the possibility to use free software and open standards when they're interacting with their public bodies. And in this very complex policy field, OFE and FSFE and other organizations, we need to stick together, we need to find our common interests, and we need to continue delivering a strong voice for free software and open standards.
Thank you, Carsten. Just to finish off, I think both the two organizations are very different in sometimes in our language and what we focus on, but we've got very much a common view on the importance of a clear definition of open standards. For OFE, we're also trying to move the language and the discussion up the level into the area of the impact of the business models, in the impact of innovation. So any of you that go on to the Open Forum site, which you see on the next slide in a moment, you can also, we're running a summit conference on the 10th of June, so anybody who's based in Europe or fancies visiting Brussels on the 10th of June, very welcome to come to that. And that's all about trying to widen the contact base and getting it up a different level. So in front of you is our two contacts, so either of us would be delighted to hear from you by emails, but that's enough from us. Back to you, Michael.
Great. Thank you so much. It's really great to have both of you on the phone, and I certainly welcome the great work that you guys have done when I visited the European Commission offices in Brussels last year and the year before. I recognize the great work that you've done in terms of educating and informing important people in this discussion. I would like to go back a couple of slides to the threats slide, because you raised in my mind some interesting questions. The history that I have seen of free software and the history of open source has often been born under conditions that have created revolutions. And one of my mentors always told me, revolutions are seldom initiated by landowners. As I was driving into work today, I heard a report that the Spanish Parliament was preparing to vote itself a 15% pay cut. And that's obviously a very bold recognition that not is all well with the economy in Europe. Now, when I joined Red Hat as CTO back in 2000, we visited many folks on Wall Street who were very interested in the technical capabilities that free software gave them, building advanced trading platforms, et cetera. But there was a huge reluctance to ditch billions of dollars of proprietary investments just because free software or open source was better. But then September 11th happened, and the economics of the entire world changed dramatically. And we had CIOs who told us point blank, we really don't care if we could save $200 million a year, asking us, could we still save $200 million a year if we start right now? And the question I want to ask you guys is, has Europe reached yet a sufficient state of economic crisis that all this posturing and positioning and Machiavellian use of proprietary lobbying interests, can we hope that that could be replaced by a sort of a new recognition that the time is now to make some serious changes and to effect the kind of economic benefit that interoperability, better innovation, better inclusivity, all these values of free software and open source can bring, and really have Europe turn this crisis into opportunity?
Well, this is Graham. I'll come in perhaps first. There are some signs of that. One of the problems, though, is, again, we talk about Europe. I think it's not going to happen and be driven out of the center in the way that we'd probably like to see. Absolutely, what you just said, Michael, is core to the messages that we're taking out there. And, in fact, that's a key part of the summit conference we're running in a couple of weeks' time. There are some signs that that's being understood. But what we're trying to do, I think, is see it in two different ways. As I said, just taking the UK as one country, I'm a Brit, so I know it quite well. The UK government published a new guide to open standards, open source, and reuse. And there's no question that at the centre of the then Labour, was then the Labour government, the driver for that was the wish to make significant savings on reuse of software. And that's where they saw the number one driver of open source. Many of us would obviously discuss other areas like reuse and aspects and all those other parts of it. But there was, if you like, an element there of a recognition of the opportunity just straightly in different economy, different factors, here's a way of making a change. Now, the problem in the UK was, though, that when that was driven down into local government, into the different budget holders in the different regional departments, they were much more concerned about spending their existing budget, and it was easier to stay as is, i.e. continuing using their proprietary software stacks, than make the changes out of it, because they saw that as a risk factor to them. But what's now happening is those budgets that I talked about are going to be slashed in this year in the UK, and I suspect that will be happening in other countries as well across Europe. And it's at that point when people will be forced to do things differently. They will need to think differently. And in the UK, at least, that's now been recognized. So for new IT projects, there is now a factor coming so that when somebody does their analysis and makes a recommendation, they have to look at total cost of ownership within the evaluation. And in that TCO, if it is taking or continuing an existing proprietary piece of software, they have to put in effectively a false cost in to justify So instead of saying moving to open source, they're saying, well, we haven't got that training cost. They actually have to put a factor in of what it would have cost if they've moved from that or will move from it in the future. So it's just one step. Carsten, any comments you want to put in?
I think that's a very good example of how the economic crisis really makes some governments rethink, but I don't think all European governments are at that point. I'm from Germany, living in Germany, although hardly, just by 200 meters or so. But the German government doesn't actually show many signs of reversing its stance on basically mostly insisting on proprietary software. On the other hand, Europe really isn't, as Graham said, isn't as coherent as it looks, as it might look from afar. Now, one example against the thesis that the economic crisis actually helps free software would be Romania, where they've been having an economic crisis for the better part of 20 years, for all intents and purposes. And there, in I believe 2007 or 2008, they decided to sign a contract with Microsoft for $500 million for proprietary software licenses, which totally mystifies me and mystifies many other citizens. Now, that being said, I think that the economic crisis does indeed represent an opportunity, and as with OFE, it's a key part of FSFE's message that free software opens up the opportunity for huge savings. And what Graham described in the British public sector is really getting the right procedures in place to make sure that public servants actually do their homework before ordering the next update to their proprietary stack is really key, getting those procedures in place. So that's what we'll be pushing.
Right. So for those of you who are attending this webinar, if you want to ask questions, you can type them in and relay them through me. We are very, very happy to take your questions. But thinking a little bit about the more about this Romanian question and the economic crisis, another statistic, as I don't know how much Europe is aware of the fact that America is completely reevaluating its food and agricultural policies. I think we finally discovered, it's taken us a while to admit this, that on average we are not eating as healthily as we should. And a statistic I just saw last night is that if Americans were to actually follow the recommendations of how many vegetables to eat, we are 13 million acres short of the necessary production capacity for feeding ourselves with our own capabilities. And I know that one of the things that gives me some hope that Europe can put together a good IT policy is that in many other disciplines, Europe takes very seriously the separation between policy and legislation, and people who do policy are actual professionals who have a serious grounding in the consequences of their decisions. It seems that IT has not been the kind of recognized competence that other issues like water management and agricultural policy and safety and engineering have been. And as a result, IT is much more a victim of politics than a beneficiary of true policy. But, you know, on this side of the pond, we are waking up to the fact that we have engineered out of our reach the ability to actually follow sensible policies. And I wonder, is there a hope that Europe will be educating and installing people who have a legitimate concept of proper IT policy to balance the lobbying and the legislature?
Well, if I can come in here, I think, yes, we're working on it. I definitely see that perspective, but it's a long, long way. Now, the way that IT, in my view, differs from sectors like water management is it's extremely fast-moving. It's very competitive. It's a highly dynamic market. In this sort of whitewater scenario, even the best professionals can, when they get into a decision-making position in policy, they find themselves buffeted by interests and lobbyists from all sides, not to mention their own bureaucratic pressures. So it's quite difficult, but we can do it. We just need to stick with the task and make clear what our core message is, get it across, and tell the decision makers that, yes, open standards and free software are the way to go for a sound IT policy in Europe.
Yeah, this is Graham. I'm an optimist by nature, so despite the high complexity of the European Commission, we do see signs that there are some very good policy makers at the centre. The formation of the digital agenda and all of our informal conversations with those people do suggest they understand the issues very well. You know, they are determined to move it forward, but it is going to take a lot of time, and I'm sure we'll be taking two steps forward and then one step back constantly on the route forward.
Now speaking of resources, one resource that I realized maybe was missing from your slide was a reference to the European Open Source Observatory. I think that the kind of research that has been done, the kind of case studies that have been published, when OSAR started publishing its results, and I'm actually not sitting in front of a computer, so I can't tweet out the URL, but somebody here can look that up.
It's www.osor.eu. Know it off by heart.
That's it, osor.edu. In any event, the case studies and analysis were so well done that I printed out a handful of them, and I came down to our own customer success story people, and I said, you know what, we should be writing success stories like this, because these are comprehensive. These explain something. And I do think that it continues to publish really excellent, thoughtful work. And I would encourage that even if you don't live in Europe, read some of those stories to understand the comprehensive benefit that a good choice in software technology and licensing can make.
Thanks. If I can jump in here, that really honors me, because actually until 2009 I was part of the team that wrote and actually personally wrote many of those case studies for OSOR. I was working for the United Nations University, which was a contractor there. So, but I think that OSOR, you're right, it continues to put out very, very good research. Like, for example, a guideline for the public sector on how to procure free software, which makes it clear that it's totally in line with public policy, with procurement policy to do so. It's totally legal, even if you can just download the stuff off the internet, and shows public servants how to actually get free software into their procurement policies and make use of it on a much greater scale. And that's actually the sort of groundwork that we really, really need to push free software forward.
Excellent. Karsten, it's obvious your problem is you're too modest. So I want to thank both of you for your participation. I hope you can stay with us for some of the other sessions that are coming up. We are scheduled to take a brief 15-minute break, and if you have ideas that you've come up with during that break, again, feel free to send them in. At 10:45, we'll be starting with Matt Jadud, Assistant Professor of Computer Science at Allegheny College, talking about teaching open source. And so I welcome everybody to refresh their coffee, stretch their legs, and join us again at 10:45. You'll be hearing some music on hold while we take a break. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Michael.